Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, recorded Friday, April 14th, 2017, for Monday, May 1st, 2017. Dori Shafrir. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/triangulation. And by Betterment, a smart, easy-to-use, and less expensive way to invest for your financial future. Get 1 month managed free when you make an initial deposit of $10,000 or more at betterment.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is a show where we talk to some of the most interesting, smartest people in tech today. I am Megan Maroney, and I'm super excited to talk to Dori Shafrir. She is the author of Startup, a novel, which I just finished. It's amazing. She's also a tech writer. She's a culture writer at BuzzFeed. She has written for Rolling Stone, The New York Observer, Gawker, Wired, so many others. A great writer and editor. Welcome to the show, Dori.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So I loved the book. I wanted to start a little bit before we get into that with a little bit of your background. I know that you write about tech culture now. You also used to write mostly about culture, non-tech culture. I'm not even sure if there is a thing that's non-tech culture anymore. Talk a little bit about what your beat is now.
Yeah, sure. So I'm actually about to switch beats. I'm going to be switching over to the tech team. So I really will be writing more about tech culture, which, as you point out, is kind of interchangeable at this point with culture, quote unquote, broadly defined. But, you know, I'd written about startups and tech in the past. I wrote this cover story for New York Magazine in 2010 about the burgeoning startup scene in New York. That was kind of the first big story about New York's startup world, first mainstream story about it. And, you know, even writing this book and just kind of my general interest in tech and startups, it kind of made sense for me to move over to tech. So I will start that on May 8th once my little book tour is done.
So talk a little bit about your first job. I know you've been, it seems like pretty much out of college, you've been writing, you've been a journalist. Talk a little bit about your first jobs right out of college, what that was like. Obviously a little bit different than what it's like to be a journalist now.
Yeah. So my first job out of college in journalism was at a company called Vault.com that is, I believe, still around, that does like dossiers on companies. And I wrote a book about the consulting industry when I was, you know, when I was like 22 or 23. Did I know that much about the consulting industry? Probably not, but I did do a ton of research on it. And that was like, you know, I guess, Internet 1.0, you know, it was the first internet bubble. And it was like this crazy time where the company founders kind of talked openly about how they were going to like IPO. We were all going to be rich. And of course, that didn't happen. The market crashed. No one really got rich. But I then, a couple years later, I went to work for an alt weekly in Philadelphia called Philadelphia Weekly, and worked there for a couple years as the arts and entertainment editor. And then I moved back to New York and went to Columbia Journalism School, and then started working for Gawker. And that kind of jump-started, I guess, the second phase of my career.
So are you finding, I mean, you have a journalism degree. Are you finding that a lot of the writers and editors that you work with have gone to journalism school, or is there a lot of just jumping right in to writing for the web?
Yeah, you know, it really varies. I think, you know, my boss is not like a huge fan of journalism school, and yet there are quite a few people I work with who do have journalism degrees, just for one reason or another, whether it's an undergrad degree or a grad degree. But I do think that the barrier to entry now is probably, it's not lower, but I think it's there's just more opportunities for you as a young journalist to make a name for yourself in a way that was not the case when I was starting out. Print was just so much more dominant, and the gatekeepers there were more, I guess, traditionally minded, which I don't think is the case now.
And how did you get started at BuzzFeed, and how has it changed since you've been there?
So I started at BuzzFeed in February of 2012, which, you know, over 5 years ago, which is kind of crazy at this point. But I kind of knew Ben Smith. We had never actually met, but we had a lot of friends in common, and we had worked at a bunch of the same places, just never at the same time. And we started emailing. I think maybe we had initially been DMing on Twitter. I had congratulated him on his new role. He had just been hired as editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed. And he was like, well, I'm actually looking for someone to be an executive editor and to handle kind of featurey things and arts and entertainment, you know, stuff that I was at Rolling Stone at the time, stuff that I had a strong background in. And so I said, sure, let's get drinks. And we really hit it off. And so I started there. There were, I want to say, 15 editorial employees at the time, five of whom had like just been hired. So, you know, it was a really small team. The entire company, I think, had like 60 or 65 people. And they'd just gotten I think it was their second round of, I think it was their Series A, maybe it was their Series B. I can't remember, but they'd just gotten a bunch of funding and had all these big plans. And I was really excited about it. I'd never had the opportunity to kind of build something from the ground up. So that was a big part of it for me. And indeed, we really got to build something. And, you know, now there's over 1,500 people at BuzzFeed, including an editorial staff of like 400, I think.
Wow. So you moved from being an editor to a writer in 2015.
Yes.
Is that a common move that people make? And what made you decide to make it the move?
You know, I think that it's not as uncommon as we think. I think, you know, in my career, I've gone back and forth from being a writer and an editor. My job at Philadelphia Weekly was as an editor, and then I went back to being a writer. So I have, and at Rolling Stone, I was an editor. So, you know, I've kind of gone back and forth. I think that having experience as an editor makes me a better writer, and having experience as a writer makes me a better editor. So it's all kind of a piece, I think. When I switched back to writing at BuzzFeed, I just really missed it. You know, previous editing jobs I'd had, I did have a little bit more time to be writing, and my job at BuzzFeed was just so all consuming. I really didn't have time to write, and I really missed it. And fortunately, by that point, we had gotten big enough that it wasn't hard for me to transition to being a writer. So I feel very fortunate in that regard.
And at that point, having been at BuzzFeed since almost the beginning, were you able to write more of what you wanted to write than you might have if you had started writing earlier on there?
Wait, sorry, what do you...
my question is, if you start as a writer, you know, an entry level writer, are you, and then do you have to write more of what people are telling you to write? Do you have more autonomy, I guess, now, so having been there, or is BuzzFeed work like writers get to write about what they want to write about?
Yeah, I mean, I think most writers at BuzzFeed have a pretty high degree of autonomy. I mean, certainly more than any other place I've worked. I'm sure, you know, since I have been there for a long time, I probably have more autonomy than I realize, you know, compared to some other people. But at least in my experience, reporters are pretty self-directed. There's not a ton of, you know, straight ahead assigning, like, you must do this story. They're pretty flexible, which I think is unusual. And something that I don't think people there take it for granted at all.
Well, let's talk about your book. It came out April 25th. You can get it at bookstores or online, anywhere where books are sold. I wanted to start by asking you to read one of my favorite passages. It takes place near the beginning of the book. One of the main characters, who is a tech journalist, is a reporter, is attending a dinner of a startup founder, and she goes into this description of founders in general. So if you could read it, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. Katya knew Andrew as well as she knew most of the successful 20-something founders in the startup scene, which was to say, both not very well and rather intimately all at once. She didn't really know Andrew Shepherd person, but she knew him just like she knew practically all of these guys. They were runners and foodies and cyclists. They all wore fitness trackers and competed with one another about who had run the most miles or slept the optimal 7.5 hours. They donated money to charities started by their friends that taught underprivileged kids how to code, but voted against raising taxes to make those kids' schools better. They participated in hackathons and marathons. They climbed mountains. They loved South by Southwest. They thought everyone, including themselves, were where they were entirely because of hard work and innate creativity. And if you weren't successful, that was because you hadn't tried hard enough. They didn't understand people who weren't just like them.
I think that is such an amazing passage. It really gets at so many of the things, the problems in Silicon Valley, the problems of the the tech industry. I keep wanting to say Silicon Valley, but this takes place in Silicon Alley. I want to start with that idea that they didn't believe that if you weren't successful, it means you weren't trying hard enough. This idea of meritocracy that was this myth. I think it's been debunked a bit, but can you talk a little bit about how that is or hopefully was pervasive in the tech scene?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that there is a degree of myopia in the sense that people who associate with people who are just like them, there's a little bit of confirmation bias happening. You see people around you who it seems like they have done it on their own, quote unquote. But these are people who, you know, went to all the right schools. They happen to be white. They happen to be male. They've been associating with the same types of people for their entire lives. They have a degree of entitlement that if you come from that world, I think it's hard to understand people who don't have that degree of entitlement and who don't think that they are entitled to get the funding or even be in the room to get the funding. So I think there's a lack of empathy, and I think there's a real lack of understanding. And when you've convinced yourself that you've done it on your own, kind of conveniently forgetting, oh, well, maybe your parents paid your rent when you were just starting out, or you don't have student loans because your parents paid your way through college, or, you know, all these like things that I think people just take for granted or like don't count. You know, those actually do make a big difference. If you are a person of color or a woman or someone who doesn't have those advantages, those financial advantages, or the network, if you don't have that network, you're really at a disadvantage, and you can't just chalk it up to working hard or, you know, being lucky. It's just not the same.
And then there's this idea in your book that, you know, that one of the founders is creating an app that meditation, sort of a personal growth app, like one of those apps that you think about, or one of those technologies you think about, like the people that are, I'm going to change the world with this app. And there's this idea that, you know, you're going to maybe change your world, but, you know, can't look beyond that. How have you seen that a lot in your years covering, the tech industry? And do you think that, do you see it in what apps are created, what technologies are created, and what people are hired, or is it both?
Well, I think that there is a lot of justification for some not great behavior because people see themselves as disruptive. They see themselves as quote unquote changing the world. And so that excuses a lot of things that might be a little, you know, that are just that's just not great behavior. And yeah, I mean, I think you also see it in the types of apps that get created. You know, I think until recently there was certainly a lack of apps for women that really understood women. You know, apps that were started by men for women. Like there were a lot of men who were interested suddenly in like disrupting periods. And it's like, I don't need a guy to tell me how to like disrupt my period. Why don't you fund a woman who, you know, wants to figure this stuff out? And then also I think a general problem in startups and in tech is like creating a problem that didn't exist, creating a solution for a problem that didn't exist. Like there are apps that have made people's lives better that did actually solve a problem. And then I think there are apps that someone just thought, oh, this, like the world needs this. But the world was not asking for this.
So there are some pretty crazy stories in your book. I mean, there are crazy stories that you hear in Silicon Valley all the time, but you manage to top them in many ways. Some of the ways people and characters in the book are desperate to make money, and they use technology in that way. Why did you decide to write a novel instead of trying to cover these ideas in at BuzzFeed? I mean, you do both, but what was it about? Why did you decide to write a novel about these people?
Well, so I think, you know, there's something really liberating when you've been a journalist for so many years, as I'm sure you can relate to, in writing fiction, that you are suddenly freed from all of the constraints that you've had your whole life, in terms of having to adhere to the facts. And I did start to feel like I could get at this sort of essential truth about the tech world and about these people and about New York that I wasn't able to in journalism. And I was able to infuse it with a point of view that you can't always do when you're a journalist. And so I found that really liberating. And that I think was a big part of why I felt like I needed to tell this story in fiction and not via journalism.
And so was it difficult as you were writing it? I know everyone always asks a novelist, like, what's true? What's not? Who was based on you? And I won't ask you that. But was it difficult as you were writing? Were you worried? And what process did you have to go through? Like, did someone at BuzzFeed have to read it before it was published? Or did you, do that as a favor? What was that difficult, even though it was fiction, still coming from a journalism background and having to, have someone look at it before it was published?
Yeah, so no one at BuzzFeed, I shouldn't say that. There were a couple of my coworkers, other writers, read it before it was published, but mostly because I wanted to make sure that I was accurately representing the experience of being like a young 20-something in New York accurately. Not because I was like, oh, is this going to seem like BuzzFeed? Like, you know, at least from my perspective, it doesn't seem like BuzzFeed. And no one who's read it has been like, oh my God, you wrote about BuzzFeed. I think it's pretty clearly not BuzzFeed. But, you know, because I've been in this world, or I had been in this world for so long and written about this world for so long, I was worried that some of my like unconscious biases or my attempts at kind of infusing it with my experiences, but not having it be like a one-to-one of my experiences or any one person. I was worried that, it might seem too close to a person or a situation. And so, I did have other people read it and no one was like, oh my God, this must be so-and-so. So that was a relief. I did get, you know, I've obviously gotten a lot of questions of like, who is Mac? Who is Katya? You know, and it's like, no, that's not, it's actually fiction. Like Mac is not a real person. So, you know, because I felt pretty confident in that regard, I don't really worry about someone assuming that it's them or knowing who it is. So
I didn't think it was BuzzFeed. Obviously it's TechCrunch or Gawker or Valleywag. So I guess there is that there is that idea of that relentlessness of tech journalism that, you know, like, you know, it could be any of these places. The sort of like Katya, the reporter, has this, she feels like she has to get a scoop. And can you talk a little bit about that and what that has done to tech reporting, that just constant, like, got to get this many views, got to get this many. I guess her thing is she needs not just views, but engagement. That's her issue. She needs to do something that engages people.
Yeah. I mean, and not just engagement, but also impact. That, you know, that's something that her boss, Dan, kind of pulls her aside at the beginning of the book and tells her, you know, between us, like the higher ups are becoming obsessed with impact and engagement. And, you know, it's not going to matter that much anymore if your story gets all the traffic, if, you know, it doesn't have the impact. And then she's like, well, how are you measuring impact? And he's sort of like, well, you know, we don't really know. I wouldn't say that is like entirely based on real life, but it's not far from it. And I don't think that it's just tech journalism. I think it's pretty much all of online journalism. The goalposts keep shifting. You know, one day it's just sheer traffic numbers. The next day it's how many people have shared your piece on Facebook. The next day it's, you know, how many people commented. The next day it's how long did people stay on your page. The next day it's what's your bounce rate. The next day, you know, so it's just like every day there's some new metric that journalists have to kind of measure themselves against. And I think, especially for a young journalist, I think that can be really disorienting, because you just never understand like what you're being measured against. And that also, I think, makes it easy for editors or managers to kind of capriciously fire people or reassign people because they've suddenly decided that the work they were doing previously isn't good enough anymore, even though it was fine like last week. So I think that has really changed things for journalists. I mean, in the olden days of print journalism, I'm not saying that it was better back then either. Like, I think one of the detriments of print journalism is like, you never really knew how many people are reading your story, or there was no way to measure impact at all. So I am certainly not arguing that we go back to that. You know, just because your magazine or newspaper had a high circulation, you didn't know how many people were reading your piece or what they thought of it. And I don't think that that's better either. But I think that what online journalism has done is like, we just keep changing our minds about what's important.
I want to talk about the idea, just the line, I'm not giving a spoiler, that there's a lot of issues of sexual harassment and what it's like to be a woman in the workplace. And it's about the tech world. It's also about the media, the world of media. So do you think that this problem of sexual harassment is bigger in the world of media and tech, or is it pervasive and we just tend to hear more about it in these worlds?
I mean, I don't really have a basis of comparison. I think it's probably bad everywhere. What I personally find particularly egregious about issues of gender discrimination and sexual harassment in tech and media is that there's this implication that because tech is changing the world, quote unquote, that everything about it is better. And that's just not true. And I think with media, you also see that hypocrisy where, you know, we're exposing instances of sexual harassment, of gender discrimination, but the places exposing them aren't always, you know, practicing what they preach. So that was a thread that I really wanted to kind of emphasize in the book, the hypocrisy that I do think is prevalent in media and tech.
And we talked a little bit about the meritocracy, that idea. And I think that Jenna Wortham in The New York Times had this excellent piece over the weekend in The New York Times Magazine about that, the idea of this utopia that John Perry Barlow created, you know, the Declaration of Independence of cyberspace. And you know, this is a new world that we're creating and everything's going to be wonderful. But what she says is really no one was able to just check their bias at the door. Like no one was able to, you know, stop being racist or sexist or discriminatory in any other ways. And so it's this idea that that it doesn't exist that made it worse. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, a study just came out yesterday. Something that reminded me of what you just said is a study came out yesterday where, you know, they made these AI bots, and the bots almost immediately became racist and sexist, because society is racist and sexist. Like our language is racist and sexist. And I think it's going to take a lot more than just kind of proclaiming that you're not racist and sexist to actually not be racist and sexist. So I think that's a little bit of what Jenna was trying to get at. And yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Mm-hmm. So I think the purpose of, I mean, there are many purposes of a novel. I don't think the purpose of fiction is to solve society's problems, but I think would you agree that your book is satire? Would you agree with that description?
You know, it's been called satire. I didn't set out to write it as a satire per se. I think it definitely has like satirical elements to it. I don't know. You know, I wasn't intending to write a satire. I should say that. But you know, I think if people are reading it as a satire, that's fine.
Well, I think satire is really interesting right now. I mean, it's so difficult to do online. It's so difficult to do on Twitter, on Facebook. You see people just mess up repeatedly when they're trying to be satirical. And it just fails because it's hard to do satire in a tweet or even in a short piece that's just going to disappear, where I think there's more of a satirical tradition in novels. And so, yeah, I think... yeah, I wanted to ask if you thought it was a satire, because I had also heard about it described as a satire. But do you think that, I mean, was that one of the purposes to kind of look at why it's so difficult to solve the sexual harassment problem? I mean, these are personal characters that have their own possible solutions to the problem. But was that part of your aim?
I think my aim was to be subversive. Which I think is a little bit different from satire. I definitely wanted people to kind of think about their own biases, their own hypocrisies, to take a long, hard look in the mirror. I definitely was sort of going for that. Someone emailed me or tweeted at me. I forget. Someone who had read an advanced copy of the book recently said to me, like, oh, you know, you did such a good job with portraying these worlds. My husband works in media. He's such a Dan. And I was like, ooh. I don't know if that's such a great thing, but okay.
Did you get to the end of the book?
Yeah, exactly.
Or even the beginning, really.
Hey. So, you know, I guess to each his own, you know, but that did sort of, I was a little bit taken aback by that. I don't know if that's something I would, you know, be going around bragging about, but whatever.
Well, you said earlier that you ran the book by some younger women to see if you portrayed them well enough. And as an older woman who did come back to this world after having some kids and I didn't take some time off, but not, you know, just changing jobs, leaning back a little bit and then leaning back in. I think that you really do capture that character and her difficulties and the totally different kind of sexism that she faces in the world. Can you talk a little bit about what your aim for that character was,
Sabrina? So the character Megan's talking about, excuse me, is Sabrina, and she's 36, which, you know, in the world is not old. But at Takeoff, which is the startup that she works at, it is old. She's one of the oldest people there. Her boss is 26. The founder of the company, Mac, is 28. She's been out of the workforce for 5 years. She has two kids. She is living this life that pretty much no one else at her company can understand, even though it's not that unusual of a life, you know, to be a 36-year-old woman with two kids. But I think that that gets back to a little bit of the tunnel vision of some of these startups that consciously or not, they end up hiring people who are just like them and solving problems, you know, for people who are just like them. Like to Mac, one of the biggest problems that he sees is like feeling frustrated that it's raining and you can't get an Uber. And like, yeah, that's a problem. But like in the grand scheme of things, it's not really a huge problem. Like you're in New York City. There are other ways to get around. So, you know, I think Sabrina represents a little bit more of like, she's sort of a reality check. But she's also like so confused. Like she realizes the ridiculousness of where she works and the situation that she's in. And yet like, she needs this job. She needs the paycheck. And for her self-esteem, I think she also needs the job. So she's kind of trying to do her best while also being like, where am I? What is happening? Why is this 26-year-old who, you know, who probably like knows social media? She's a social media. She does social media for this company. And even though her 26-year-old boss like knows social media better than she does, she's not a great boss or a great manager. She's good at social media. But I think that's something that we also see at a lot of startups is like people who have been on the job for 2 or 3 years getting promoted to these manager positions that they're just not qualified for and don't really know how to do. And there's no support for them. Like no one is telling Isabel, who's Sabrina's boss, no one's giving her feedback about how to be a good manager. That's just, you know, there's been no training for her about how to be a manager. It was just like, okay, you've been here for a while. You're a manager now. So I think Sabrina's also like, whoa, what is this? Like in my previous life career, you know, it didn't matter that if she had a manager who was younger than her, it was that the manager at least had experience being a manager, or had, you know, support for being a manager, and her current manager does not.
There's also a lot of interesting stuff about workplace culture and how that just amazes Sabrina. Like there's a pole dancing class that everyone in the workplace is asked to participate in or invited to participate in. Can you talk a little bit about about your thoughts of workplace culture in the tech world?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just been a lot of blurring of lines that I think a lot of people now in their 20s just kind of expect that work is going to be their life in kind of all facets. Like they date people they work with, they are roommates with people they work with, they hang out with people they work with. And, you know, for Sabrina, 10 years ago, when she was 26, it was like, maybe you went out for drinks after work with people you worked with, but you had other friends, you had another life beyond work. And so she's like very confused by this. And there seems to be a blurring of boundaries that she is also really unfamiliar with. Like in her previous life, first of all, there probably wouldn't even be a pole dancing workshop in existence, let alone one that you would take with your coworkers. So she's just constantly, there's just constantly new things that she is like, what is happening? Every day there's something new.
So you wrote a piece recently for BuzzFeed about women founders and how that might not be actually the solution to all our problems, some founders don't practice what they preach. But at the same time, you write that, you know, they're also held to a different standard. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, as I mentioned before, I think a common thread through much of what I write is like just noting people's hypocrisy. And the thing that I wanted to hone in on the feminists, the female founders piece, is these founders who espouse these very feminist ideals publicly. Like, these are all three women who I talked about in the piece, Miki Agrawal, Sophia Amoroso, and Arianna Huffington. They've all written books. Arianna and Sophia more explicitly feminist, but Miki too, you know, about kind of espousing their business, how to sort of get ahead in business and like be a badass. And they talk a lot about that. But then at their own companies internally, behind the scenes, like, things were a mess, and you have all these employees saying, well, you know, they didn't offer maternity leave, or I got fired when I was pregnant, or, you know, in the case of Miki, like, my boss grabbed my boobs, or like, just all these things that you're like, well, wait a second, this does not at all align with what you claim you are.
So just having a woman at the helm is not, that's not the magic bullet, I guess.
No, I mean, look, I don't think anyone is perfect. And again, like, I don't think women should be held to a higher standard, but I think everyone should just try to practice what they preach. Like, it shouldn't be that hard. And you know what? If you want to be a boss, fine. Like, if you don't want to offer maternity leave or paid maternity leave, or you want to fire people when they're pregnant, like, okay, but then don't turn around and publicly say how much you support women. Like, that just doesn't track for me.
So it's so that's your beat, the hypocrisy beat.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about your other writing for BuzzFeed, but first I want to take a second to thank our sponsor. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one meal delivery service. We get it at Blue Apron at our house. We get it the family plan, and we can pick what we're going to get every week. If there's a week that we don't want, we can skip it. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Now, if you spend a lot of time at restaurants or you shop at high-end grocery stores, you can spend a lot of money. But with Blue Apron, you can spend under $10 per person for a delicious meal that you cook yourself at home. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. They ship the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, and then that way they reduce food waste. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they will make it right. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental United States. There's no weekly commitment. You get deliveries only when you want them, and you can customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences. If you're a vegetarian, great. If you're a pescatarian, great. They've got it all. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. Here's what's on the menu: baked spinach and egg flatbread with sauteed asparagus, lemon aioli, beef teriyaki stir fry with sugar snap peas and lime rice, crispy salmon and roasted potato salad with pickled mustard seeds and creme fraiche sauce, or three cheese and baby broccoli stromboli with tomato and oregano dipping sauce. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/triangulation. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals by Blue Apron. Don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/triangulation. And we thank Blue Apron for their support of the show. I am Megan Maroney, and I am talking to Dori Shafrir. She is a writer at BuzzFeed and the author of Startup, a novel that is available at bookstores everywhere where books are sold. It is a great book. I highly recommend it. So let's, you have some great pieces for BuzzFeed. It's like you, I mean, it's this great body of work. I feel like, it would be an encyclopedia if you put everything together that you've done. One piece I wanted to talk about was, last fall you wrote about attending your own digital funeral. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So this was part of an exhibit at LACMA. I live in Los Angeles, so this was at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. They have a year-long fellowship program. I believe it's for art and technology. And so they had given a fellowship to this guy, Gabriel Garcia Colombo, who had an art project called the Hereafter Institute that was... its goal was to kind of make people think about their digital afterlives. And so I went through, you were kind of walked through the exhibit with a guide from his, you know, his fictional institute, and sort of put through all these exercises about your own digital afterlife and seeing what other people who had actually died, like these were real people who had died, the way their digital afterlives had been preserved. Like when he had this piece of art that was scrolling tweets of someone who had died, and he had this virtual reality thing with the voices of people who had died. It was like very cool, very creepy, and definitely made me think about my own digital legacy. You know, yeah. Oh, and then at the end, you went to your own digital funeral where he had... you ahead of time, he had taken all of your social media and kind of come up with a eulogy for you. And then, excuse me, and then had a bunch of your tweets scrolling on this screen that you see here. And the effect was like very disconcerting. And it did make me think like, oh my God, like if I did die today, God forbid, like what would be out there for people to kind of piece together about me? And what conclusions would people draw? And like, is my last tweet going to be a complaint about United Airlines or something? You know, is that going to be your legacy? So it's weird because you don't want to, excuse me, you can't kind of constantly be thinking about this. You don't want to become obsessed with your own death. But I think that there are some things that everyone can do to just sort of like make sure that things don't go off the rails when you die. For one thing, you know, on Facebook, you can designate a, like a, I forget what they call it.
I think a designator or something. It's not benefactor, but I know what you're talking about.
You can designate a person to kind of take over your Facebook account if you, in the event of your death. And then your account turns into a, like if you go to the account, if you go to the profile, it'll say like remembering Dori Shafrir instead of just as if Dori Shafrir were still alive. So that's like one simple thing you can do. You can also like make sure that someone, you know, someone has all the passwords to your social media. And I think also just kind of, you know, in general, it's probably not the worst idea for everyone to be just a little bit more mindful about the things that they post on social media. So, you know, it's not like every single thing I post, I think like, oh my God, what if this was my last Instagram? Like, you see those, like, I just always think of those horrible articles of like, this hiker, the last Instagram before this hiker like fell off a cliff, and it's like, you know, a selfie where some girl looks like super happy and tanned and she's like, love the view. And then it's like an hour later, she fell to her death, you know, and you do sort of think like, oh God, like what if that was my last Instagram? But also, you know, you're dead. What are you going to do?
Exactly. But I do. I was so glad to read this because I do. I often do that morbidly when you see, you just like, what was the last thing they posted?
Totally. Totally. We all do it. It's, you know, it's a totally natural. It's a human impulse. to kind of go to someone's Facebook page or go to someone's Twitter and just be like, oh, like that. It's a reminder of our own mortality, I think. And I don't think it's like a bad thing to do, but it is a little sobering.
Well, to think about it, I think it's good because I'm, you know, there's that, I don't know if you watch Black Mirror, but there's that creepy Black Mirror episode where, you know, and I think there is technology that's either being worked on or that exists that will take, you know, all your social media posts and maybe make a simulacrum, I can never pronounce that word.
Simulacrum.
Yes, that's the one of you. And so, yeah, it's creepy, but I guess one thing I think that, that is good. The tech industry has gotten us talking about death, which is something that is really taboo. And I would love for you or someone else to prove me wrong, but I do think that of any of the things like this, it doesn't seem to be a place that seems sexist or racist. The disruption of death.
Well, the only thing is that, you know, there is this group of like middle-aged white guys in Silicon Valley who are trying to like live forever, which is a little creepy in my opinion.
Right. Like, yeah, that is true. Yeah. Just that kind of, I mean, that is also captured in the piece, in the passage that you read about the, you know, you get the optimal amount of sleep, you're, you know, running marathons and competing with each other and just like trying to, you know, I mean, you didn't say this, but like spend 30 minutes in an ice bath or, you know, all these ways that you see those people just really trying to perfect their already wonderful lives.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your podcast, if that's okay. You have a podcast with your husband, Matt Mira. It is Dory and Matt's Excellent Adventure with Eggs. And it's about your journey to make a baby with the help from science. I listened to a couple of episodes. It's one of those times where you realize, like, if you have two really interesting people talking about a topic, it can be fascinating, even if I am not experiencing what you're experiencing. I loved listening to it. Talk a little bit about why you started. Your husband, Matt, is from The Nerdist. Some people watching this might know him. Whose idea was it to start the podcast?
It was my idea. Matt was initially reluctant, in part because he already has a million podcasts. In fact, in the background, you can see a poster from one of his other podcasts, James Bonding. He does a bunch of podcasts. He was sort of like, another podcast. But one of the reasons that I was so sort of keen to do it is because he had asked if it would be okay for him to talk about it on The Nerdist. And I said, sure. And he talked about it. I think, on the episode with Patrick Stewart. And then he talked about it at Comic-Con last year at the Nerdist Live show. And I started noticing that on Twitter, he was getting so many guys in particular responding to him, being like, hey, man, you know, thanks for talking about, because we're doing IVF. And he was like, they were like, thanks for talking about IVF. Like, my wife and I are doing it and no one talks about it. And I haven't talked about it with anyone. And I was like, wow, you know, women, it's a taboo subject for a lot of women, but at least we have these other, we have like Facebook groups and message boards and we can commiserate with each other. And for men, there was like nothing. You know, I've talked to men in other couples who I know have gone through IVF and they've been like, yeah, you know, I didn't tell any of my friends that we were doing it. I felt really alone. I think especially for men who it's, you know, male factor infertility, which can be a number of different things. It can be, you know, low sperm count. I don't want to get too technical, but like it can be various things. And I think for those men especially, they feel very isolated and guilty. And so you had a lot of people, I saw a lot of people reaching out to Matt and I was like, you know, we should talk about this more. Like, I think that they're not just men. There's a audience for, there's a need for this, for people who just want sort of like frank, open, not, I guess like lighthearted, you know, we definitely like make jokes and we talk very honestly about it. And I was like, I think there's a need for this. And Matt was like, well, I'm going to ask my Twitter followers. So
right. Why ask my wife when I can ask my Twitter followers?
So he did it. He put a poll on Twitter and was like, my wife wants me to do an IVF podcast. should we do it? And I'm proud to say that 80% of the people who responded to the poll said yes, which was even higher than I thought it was going to be. And I think definitely actually surprised him. So we've been doing it since October. We've done 25 episodes. We do them pretty much once a week. And it's been really great. We have a Facebook group that's very active, where people talk about, you know, IVF, all kinds of stuff. And we hear from tons of people. And I think it's, you know, I think it's opened up a conversation in a way that I was hoping for, but has kind of exceeded my expectations.
Yeah, it sounds like you get a lot of feedback, even from people who aren't going through the process, people with children. You've gotten a lot of community feedback?
Yeah, I mean, and actually, we were hoping that it would be a good resource for people who are going through IVF. But what we have realized is that it's just as valuable that people who are not going through IVF are listening to it, because we get so many messages from people who are like, thank you for helping me understand what it's like to go through IVF. Like, my sister went through IVF, or my best friend is going through it, and I got pregnant right away, and she seemed so angry with me, and I didn't really understand, and now I understand. And, you know, so I think it's like, it's exposing this world of infertility and IVF to people who, you know, did not have firsthand experience with it. And I think the more that people understand it and have empathy for it, the better.
Absolutely. I think in your last episode, Matt talks about all the inappropriate questions you get, like, why don't you just adopt? And it's good to hear that. It's something that, you know, like we've been talking about this whole episode, if it's not your experience, you don't know. And sometimes you say really dumb things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the vast majority of people they don't have bad intentions. Mm-hmm. But they don't realize that certain things that they say to people who have been struggling with infertility are just, they're not welcome, I should say.
Well, you've been a journalist for a long time. I want to get your tips on people that might be getting started. You also have this novel that came out and is being reviewed in lots of places and picked for Book of the Month Club and so many places. I want to get some of your writing tips too. But first, I want to take a minute to thank our sponsor. So we're talking about technology, and one way that you can use technology is to help you invest smarter without paying all those fees. You're a geek. You want to use a service like Betterment. It's smart, it's easy to use, and less expensive, and it's a way to invest for your financial future or your family's financial future. You know you have to do it. It's on your to-do list, but you don't want to waste a lot of time. So try Betterment. I'm excited about Betterment. It's the largest independent automated investing service. It's really changed the industry by making investing easier at a fraction of what you would pay for traditional financial services. Betterment combines really smart technology with human advisors. They're not cutting out the human. Then you will achieve optimal results at every level of investment. Customers gain access to a team of CFP professionals and licensed financial experts who monitor accounts, and they're also able to answer your questions. You'll also receive planning calls and notifications throughout the year. They will check up on you in just the right amount of times. Betterment's goal-based investing framework and advice algorithm will let you know if you're on track, and it only takes a few seconds. You can also securely sync outside investments with Betterment so you can see your total net worth all in one place. Smart deposits allow you to automatically invest excess cash. And the Retire Guide provides a consolidated view of your retirement and calculates your retirement gap. Betterment's tax loss harvesting will help lower investment taxes and increase after-tax returns. There are no trade, transaction, or rebalancing fees, and there's no minimum to sign up. Through global diversification, smart rebalancing, and lower fees, Betterment customers can expect higher returns than a typical DIY investor. Their end-to-end investing means faster cash transfers, tax forms available at the earliest possible date, and secure investing. As with everything in life, investing involves risk. Right now, get 1 month managed free when you make an initial deposit of $10,000 or more. To learn more, visit betterment.com/triangulation. That's betterment.com/triangulation. And we thank Betterment for their support of Triangulation. I am Megan Maroney, and I am talking to Dori Schafrier from BuzzFeed, and she is also the author of the novel Startup, which is not a satire, but a great, funny story of founders in Silicon Alley. And I did have one more question about that. Why did you choose to place it in Silicon Alley instead of Silicon Valley?
Partly because there haven't really been books or movies about the New York tech scene yet. It's all been set in the Bay Area. And also it's where I'm the most familiar with. Like I've never lived in Silicon Valley. I've never worked for a Silicon Valley company. And I just thought that there was so much to be done with the interplay between the tech world and New York City itself that hadn't been explored in fiction. So that made it a really compelling setting for me.
How do you think that Silicon Alley is different than Silicon Valley?
Well, for one thing, it's in this broader ecosystem of New York. It's not, even though it's grown so much in New York, it's not the dominant industry in New York in the same way that Silicon Valley, it's all tech, it's all startups. And so in New York, I think you do find a lot more startups that have something to do with the other industries in New York, like fashion, like media, like finance. And so I think that makes it really interesting. And I think that there's just a lot more kind of cross-pollination among industries. And I think New York itself like really influences the tech world in the same way that it influences all the other, industries of New York City.
I know you're in LA now, and when I think about the LA tech scene, all I can think of is Snapchat and the issues that they're having now with growing and people kind of fighting back. What is the tech scene like? I hate to use the word tech scene because that's the name of the website. What's it like in LA?
Well, it's very concentrated on the West Side. The Silicon Beach moniker exists for a reason, because Snapchat is on the beach. There's other companies over there like Whisper. The Google LA office is in Venice. There's also in Playa Vista, there's now a ton of companies. Like there's a huge YouTube space in Playa Vista, which is also right on the beach. And you're also starting to see some companies downtown and spread out around LA. But I think the area by the beach is still the most concentrated. But Snap is the biggest IPO of an LA company and certainly the most, the most prominent. And there haven't really been the big exits that there have been in New York and certainly not in Silicon Valley. And there are VCs. There are VCs in LA, but not as many as there are in Silicon Valley or New York. So you have a situation where, Snapchat sort of famously went to an LA VC who turned them down and then was like, okay, I guess we'll go to Silicon Valley. So, I think a lot of LA companies have to go outside the city for funding. And then I think until LA has a really strong venture capital scene, it's not going to be as much of a player in tech as San Francisco or New York. And I don't know if it ever will be. I mean, I don't think that there's going to be a world where it becomes bigger than Hollywood, although, you never know. And certainly now there's a lot of cross-pollination between Hollywood and tech.
All right, let's get to some writing tips. So let's say there's someone graduating from college or not and wanting to get into writing for the web, writing for BuzzFeed or the imagined tech scene. What advice would you give them?
Well, I do think that having a strong presence on social media is important. I think especially writing about tech, if you can make a name for yourself on Twitter and become known to the world of tech journalists, that does really help. If you can come with a a social following that's already established, and you've made it clear that you can engage with people on Twitter and you know how to find news and you know how to find scoops. I think that that's really important. I think also there's, you know, there's so many different kinds of jobs right now in online journalism. There's like curation jobs that didn't exist 3 years ago. There's social jobs that didn't exist 3 years ago. So, you know, I think it's really important for people to get out of a mentality of like being an online journalist means like writing articles all the time, because I think there's a lot of different ways to be a journalist right now that don't just involve writing articles. And I think learning how to do video, if you're just starting out right now, is super important. So I would say develop those skills and be able to have those skills. I think there's, the need for skilled video journalists, the supply of skilled video journalists has not yet exceeded the demand, especially in news. So I think if you're able to do that, then you're automatically at an advantage.
And so would you offer the same advice to like the Sabrinas of the world, the 36-year-olds? I want to get involved in this and I'm not 25.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, Sabrina doesn't really want to be a news reporter. So my advice to her is a little bit different. I think if you've been out of the workforce for a few years and you want to get back into it, I think being really strong on social media, not being afraid of social media, is really important. You know, that doesn't mean that you have to be constantly on Snapchat, or, you know, you don't have to embrace every form of social media, but you have to be at least conversant in it and good at it and not afraid of it. And I think developing skills in video, in audio also, there's a lot of opportunities now in podcasts and in live audio that I think did not exist, you know, a few years ago. Just having those skills, I think, will differentiate you from people who are just writing.
Yeah, I definitely think that's great advice, not being afraid of it. Because I think some people who might have been out of the workforce or just like don't know what, are afraid of Snapchat or, you know, Instagram, or, you know, figuring out what is next. And it's really not. I mean, once you spend some time with it, it's not really that. They intentionally, I think, make it harder for people to figure it out. But it's not really that hard.
Totally.
And so what about the budding novelists? The people that, you know, especially journalists or non-journalists, someone who feels like they have a story in them, how do they get over that hump to actually bringing it to the world?
Well, I think, you know, the cliche is true. Like, you just have to do it. The way I started writing the book was at the time I was not writing full time at BuzzFeed. I was editing and managing, and I decided I just needed my own project. And I just started writing every day for a month. And at the end of the month, I had 60 pages and was like, oh, okay, maybe this is a thing. So I think that just starting and just like, I was reading an interview with another author recently, and she was saying it's easy to start things and it's exciting to start things, but it's hard to finish things, and you just have to finish. You just have to finish. Like, don't start a million projects. Just finish something, and then you can start the next thing.
That's really good advice. Yeah. Finish something. And so what is your process? Do you, when you were working on this, would you write every day, morning, night? What's your writing process for the novel?
Morning is like the only time I can get anything done. My ability to be, alert, sort of, you know, goes like that throughout the day. So I was waking up early and working on it and writing for a bit in the morning. And then I took some time off work. I was like using all my vacation time to work on the book. And then once I had sold the book, I sold the book on a partial manuscript of about 100 pages and an outline. And then I took a couple months off to really try to finish it. And I didn't actually finish it during those 2 months, but I then had another couple months before it was due and finished it then.
So sell it before you finish it. That's your advice.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is a real, like, your mileage may vary situation because it is hard. I'll be the first to admit it is hard to sell an unfinished work of fiction, especially if it's your first. So I don't want to, like, pretend that that's, you know, a good strategy for everyone. But, you know, I think just doing whatever you need to do to try to finish it is, I don't have, like, a magic bullet. And everyone works differently. For me, one thing that helped was, like, I work really well in, like, short bursts. So setting a timer to write for, like, half an hour with no distractions and then taking a little break and then setting another timer, like, that's just an easy thing that works for me, but that might not work for everyone. Shutting myself off from the internet was also huge. It's so easy to get distracted, whether it's from Twitter or the news or a funny video or whatever. I just needed that kind of out of my life while I was trying to work on the book.
That's great advice. I also do the Pomodoro technique with the timer. And
yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't work for everybody. But
exactly.
So have you started another novel?
I've started sort of playing around with a couple of ideas. It's been a really busy few months between the podcast and IVF and getting the book out and also working full time. So I'm trying to just sort of, like, get the book out and maybe get some of the IVF stuff sort of resolved. And then I feel like I'll have the brain space to really think about what a next book could be.
And so where are you going on your book tour? Where are your locations?
If anyone is listening today in Boston, I have an event tonight at the Trident Booksellers and Cafe on Newbury Street. It is at 7 p.m. And I'll be in conversation with the novelist Joanna Rakoff. So last week I was in New York and yesterday I was in Portland. And then Thursday I'll be in LA. I'll be in Austin on May 17th in conversation with Hugh Forrest, who's the director of South by Southwest Interactive. I'm really excited about that. And then I will be in Palo Alto. I'll be at Stanford University Bookstore on Tuesday, May 30th in conversation with Matt Honan, my colleague at BuzzFeed, who is the SF bureau chief. And then I have another appearance in San Francisco on June 1st at Book Passage in the Ferry Building. And I'll be in conversation with Sachi Kuhl, who is another BuzzFeed writer who wrote this wonderful book of essays called One Day We'll All Be Dead and None of This Will Matter.
Except for what you tweeted.
Title.
Last.
Yeah.
Like you said, it won't matter to you.
Yeah.
Well, Dori, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. The book is Startup. You can get it where books are sold. Is there an audio version?
Yes, there is an audio version.
On Audible.
It's on Audible. You can also, you could also buy it technically as a CD. if that's your thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And Dori is at BuzzFeed. She is a culture writer, but going to be a tech writer.
Yes, in a week.
In a week. So check her out there. Is it BuzzFeed.com/tech? Is that where you get the tech stories? Awesome. And you can get the podcast, Matt and Dori. It's Matt and Dori, not Dori and Matt, right?
It's Matt and Dori.
Matt and Dori's Excellent Adventure. You can get that wherever you download your podcasts. And DoriShafrir.com,
Dori-Shafrir.com. Yes.
Thank you so much. Definitely buy the book and check out Dori if you're in any of those cities where she will be. It's awesome to go hear writers and see them in person and get your book signed. So.
Yeah, I'd love to meet you.
Okay. Thank you, Dori.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching Triangulation. You can watch Triangulation every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific on the Twit Network, or you can subscribe at twit.tv/try. You can find me on Twitter. I am at Megan Maroney. Thanks so much for watching.